important. They need to transfer money. They need to have money coming in. How is that going to happen? I mean, as of this point, there isn't a system of governance in place in that country yet, at least as of the recording of this program. However, this is what a senior Taliban leader, his name is Wahidullah Hashemi, has said.
In future, this is not up to now discussed how it would be. Maybe we have a council, the head of the council, as you call the president, we would call that Rais al-Wazara or the head of the council, and we will have ministers. All the ministers would be appointed by this council and by the head of the council.
Well, that's what he has said. Well, to begin with, generating income is going to be very important to the Taliban. That answer may come in the form of what is called the informal economy. Now, the informal economy has large amounts of hidden money in the war zone. First off, opiates, as you see here, trafficking in opium, hashish, methamphetamines, and other narcotics is set to bring the Taliban revenues of anywhere between $500 to $600 million yearly. Not bad, is it? Now, since they came to power, they have vowed not to continue this illegal trade. But the biggest kind of trade that happens, the real money, comes from another area that is not that well known. That is money which comes from the illegal movement of ordinary goods. Now, it consists of things like fuel and also consumer imports. So these are the goods that are flowing in through this, what we call informal economy, which is the illegal movement of goods in this case. In size and sum, the informal economy dwarfs international aid, which again flows into Afghanistan on a yearly basis. Now, let's take a look at that source of income, which is called the informal taxation. You have the informal economy and then the formal taxation. Fees for passage of goods is what I'm talking about here. This is the collection of fees by armed personnel, the Taliban, to allow safe passage of the goods. The money produced from this taxation, $235 million annually. Now, one of the largest income producers came from an area by the name of Zaranj. That's actually a city bordering Iran. Now, this city provided the government with roughly, again, these are rough numbers, $43.2 million in terms of annual duties. Also, an additional $50 million in direct taxes for the year 2020. There was also a significant amount of undeclared trade, particularly of fuel. Total revenues from this border crossing, $176 million per year. Now, the total amount of trade through all of Afghanistan's border crossings, that needs to be looked at. Here's a map of that. The border crossings are the ones in the green. You can see them here and here. That's the ranch that I just talked about. You have one over here, Ten Gural, which is over there. And you have about four or five more. Now, these revenues are estimated to be $2 billion per year. So you can see the money generated there is quite a bit. Now, once informal trade is included, that figure is going to be actually twice as high. Well, at this point, Afghans are definitely very worried about the chain of events that happened in their country with the collapse of the government. The Afghan money is quickly losing its value, especially, for example, a neighboring country like Pakistan.
ये जो हालात बदल रहे दिन ब दिन पानी की जो पाकिस्तानी रुपीज है उसकी कदर बहुत कम हो चुका है हम लोगों ने काफ़ी नुकसान उठाया है क्योंकि कि तालिबान के आने की वजह से इतलात की वजह से पाकिस्तानी रुपये बढ़ गया और पानी जो है वो बहुत नीचे आ चुका है
Well, let's get some analysis into the picture. Our guest Phyllis Bennis joins us. She is from the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis Bennis is an American writer. She's an activist and a political commentator featured on many television stations. Her focus has been mainly on issues related to West Asia and the United Nations. She's also a very strong critic of Israel and the United States and a leading advocate of Palestinian rights. All right, Phyllis, welcome. Looking at the time that the U.S. actually invaded Afghanistan, the year 2001, up to now, $2.26 trillion to have been spent. The cost of war project at Brown University has calculated that. Now, this investment, if you want to call it that, has yielded a chaotic, humiliating end to America's longest war. What went wrong, Phyllis? Why is the Afghan government failing to deliver on its economic investments that were made by the U.S. or failed to do that and said to be rife with corruption and unfinished projects? I mean, after all, the U.S. spent $2 trillion there. And for what? That is the key question.
I think we have to recognize that the U.S. war in Afghanistan was always a kind of derivative war. It was a war of vengeance following the attacks of 9/11, despite the fact that none of the 9/11 hijackers were Afghan. They were Saudi and Egyptian. But the war was designed partly to keep up the level of tension in the United States, keep up U.S. support for a coming war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Phyllis Bennis there. Okay. She obviously says that that was not a democratic exercise when it came to the U.S. At least that's not the way that it went down. All right. Our next piece now takes a look at the reasons behind this war, which was nothing short than a cash machine, especially for military contractors, as you're about to see.
It was one of the most revealing and shocking exposés to cover the U.S.-led Afghanistan war. Bold journalism, numerous testimonials, admissions too hard to swallow, revealing the truth about the Afghan war and the lies behind it. The Afghanistan Papers. U.S. officials constantly said they were making progress. They were not, and they knew it.
Thanks to our military, our allies, and the brave fighters of Afghanistan, the Taliban regime is coming to an end.
For many of you, this will be your last tour in Afghanistan. And by the end of this year, the transition will be complete, and Afghans will take full responsibility for their security, and our combat mission will be over.
To add salt to injury, U.S. government did not even have an idea about the money splurged. No exact accounting done. But why? Maybe this revelation was the answer made back in 2011, which is one of the pillars of the U.S. so-called empire.
Because the goal is not to completely subjugate Afghanistan. The goal is to use Afghanistan to wash money out of the tax bases of the United States, out of the tax bases of European countries, through Afghanistan, and back into the hands of a transnational security elite. That is the goal, i.e. the goal is to have an endless war, not a successful.
The Afghan president described the killings as unforgivable. An American soldier is in custody after a shooting rampage that's left 16 civilians, some women and children, dead in Afghanistan's southern Kandahar province.
A shocking expose out today in The Intercept reveals CIA-backed death squads in Afghanistan have killed children as young as 8 years old in a series of night raids, many targeting madrasas, Islamic religious schools.
And they dragged the two oldest-looking boys out of that room, took them into another room, along with 10 other older-looking students. But as you already discussed, some of them were as young as 8 or 9 years old.
One of the assets that Afghanistan has, which has become a focus, is its mineral wealth. And one country in particular which appears to have its eye on it is China. Here you see China receiving a member of the Taliban recently. Since the U.S. has now withdrawn itself from the country, China may be looking to back the Taliban with Afghan mining investments. Rare earth metals in Afghanistan were estimated to be worth anywhere between $1 trillion and $3 trillion in 2020. Only hours after the Taliban overran Afghanistan, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said that Beijing was ready for friendly cooperation with Afghanistan.
Well,
our guest in this section, Marvin Weinbaum, joins us. He is scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute. He's also a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and served as analyst for Pakistan and Afghanistan in the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research from the years 1999 to 2003. Also rejoining us is Mohammad Daoud Abadi and Phyllis Bennis. Okay, Marvin, welcome. All those trillions of dollars, Afghanistan's still one of the smallest formal economies on the planet. Last year, President Ashraf Ghani said that 90% of the population was living on less than $2 a day. I mean, if the U.S. gave the money, the trillions of dollars away, the economy would be much larger. Why did this not translate to the Afghan economy?
Well, you know, a lot of it was lost through corruption. There's no question about that. This is something that the Afghans, as well as the international community, has some responsibility for. There were the resources to do far more, but again, I don't want to minimize the fact that there has been change, and along with everything that went wrong, there was a good deal that did go right.
Only the money that the U.S. invested in Afghanistan went to the people, but it didn't. I mean, Afghans living on less than $2 per day, 90% of them, I mean, that's incredible. What really happened here? I mean, there's aid money also that's involved. Donor conferences have produced billions of dollars in money every year, particularly since the invasion.
The money that was spent by the United States did not go to the people of Afghanistan. It went to a corrupt government that was put in place by the United States and that represented U.S. interests in maintaining their version of stability.
All right. Daoud, corruption, both from the U.S. and the Afghan side. You mentioned some of it before, unfinished projects, for example. We've talked about it. But why didn't the U.S. money and the aid money go to the Afghan people? Let's not forget, billions were given to Afghanistan on a yearly basis. I'm sure you know that. Ordinary Afghans, however, did not reap the benefits. What happened there?
The reason it didn't translate into an Afghan economy was because there was no planning. There was no structure. There was no strategy for spending the money. The money was, in a way, given to all these corrupt officials to keep them keep their mouths shut.
All right. Well, let's look at another issue, and that's the mineral wealth of Afghanistan. Experts are saying it'll reap $1 trillion, the actual worth. And until now, the Taliban have not tapped into it. They have profited from opium and the heroin trade. How will the Taliban get to those resources, do you think, since it does not have the money, unless China becomes a partner in this, which it has said that it's willing to do so?
Well, I need to make a correction here. It is not $1 trillion. It is $3 trillion, according to the estimates given by the West. But let's not forget that that wealth belonged to the Taliban, to the Afghan people. The Taliban are Afghans, and that is their country, that's their wealth, and it's nobody's business how they want to use their money and how they don't want to use the money.
All right, we appreciate that. That's Mohammad Daoud there contributing to our program. Mohammad Daoud is a chairman of the Afghan Nation Peace Council and previously a spokesman and negotiator for the Hizb Islami Group. Okay, we'll be right back with my final thoughts. If the U.S. actually leaves the country alone and leaves it for good, as is, it is withholding the government money that's held abroad, $9 billion worth. Now, this will be disastrous for an economy with a new administration. But the story of Afghanistan could have began 20 years ago. And if the U.S. had not invaded and then occupied it, it would have been, at a minimum, better than the state that it is in today. Make no mistake, we are not here to promote, defend, nor demonize the Taliban. Iran has stated that it will be a partner in a country that is looking for peace and stability, and has spoken to Russia and China about that. After all, it makes sense. Iran wants a stable neighbor that it can do trade with. But is the U.S. involvement with the Taliban over, or will it use the group against China or Iran? Only time will tell. That does with this edition of Economic Divide. I'm Kavit Taghwi. It's good to have been with you. Until next time.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Sulawesi has some of the world's oldest cave art, but ancient human remains have been scarce. Now a fossil with DNA hints at a mysterious lineage of people, says Bianca Nograti, writer, in an article published under the heading First Ancient Human DNA Found from Key Asian Migration Routes. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The 7,000-year-old skeleton of a teenage hunter-gatherer from Sulawesi in Indonesia could be the first remains found from a mysterious ancient culture known as the Tolins, researchers report recently in Nature. The largely complete fossil of a roughly 18-year-old Stone Age woman was found in 2015 buried in a fetal position in a limestone cave on Sulawesi. The island is part of a region known as Wallacea, which forms the central islands of Indonesian archipelago. DNA extracted from the skull suggests the woman shared ancestry with New Guineans and Aboriginal Australians, as well as with an extinct species of ancient human. This is the first time anyone's found ancient human DNA in that region, says Adam Brum, an archaeologist at the Australian Research Centre for Human Evolution at Griffith University in Brisbane, who is part of a team that described the find. The authors say she may be one of the Tolin people whose existence is known from scant archaeological evidence, such as distinctively notched stone tools, and who were thought to have lived in Sulawesi at around the same time. The remains were found alongside Tolin-type tools, providing a strong evidence of the woman's link to these little-known people, agrees Shimono Kelly, an archaeologist at Australian National University in Canberra. Wallacea is the gateway through which ancestors of modern Popan and Aboriginal Australians traveled, but very few ancient human remains have been discovered there. One of the most famous is the diminutive hobbit skeleton of early human species Homo floresiensis, which was found on the island of Flores south of Sulawesi, Indonesia. The moist tropical environment's DNA degrades rapidly in fossils, making genetic material a rare prize for researchers working in the region. The authors suspect that the skeleton's burial inside the Link Panitch limestone cave might have helped to preserve enough DNA for analysis. Adding genomic analysis to archaeological evidence provides much more insight into the early population movements and genetic diversity of people in that region, Brom says. Kelly says the simple fact that DNA has been extracted from a fossil in this challenging environment for DNA preservation is a key achievement of the project. To see these guys get enough of a sequence that they can actually do analysis on it, and from something that's 7,000 years old, which is quite impressive, that's the real excitement, she adds. The woman's genome suggests a similar level of relatedness to present-day Aboriginal Australians and New Guinea, implying that her lineage split off before either of those groups diverged from one another around 37,000 years ago, says co-author Selina Karloff, who researches population genetics at Max Planck Institute for the Science of Human History in Germany. Kelly says it's possible that the woman's ancestors were part of a movement of people migrating through Sulawesi to Australia and New Guinea around 50,000 to 60,000 years ago, but that her lineage formed an offshoot population that remained in Sulawesi. Another possibility is that her ancestors were part of a later return wave of migration back into Wallasi from Australia and New Guinea, Kelly says. The woman's genome also contained Denisovan DNA. The Denisovans are an extinct subspecies of ancient human who lived 500,000 to 30,000 years ago and whose existence is known only through fossil discoveries in Siberia and on Tibetan plateau. The presence of Denisovan genetic material, also found in people in Australia and New Guinea, suggests that Wallasi might have been a region in which Denisovans and modern humans intermingled and interbred. There is also the question of whether this individual might be linked to 44,000-year-old cave paintings discovered in 2019 in Sulawesi, regarded as some of the world's oldest known figurative cave art. It would be super interesting to be able to figure out if there were any connections between the people who made the paintings and the Tholians, says Karloff. Genetic traces in modern inhabitants, yes. The region around Link Panitch is today inhabited by people of Bugis and Makassar cultures of Indonesia. These people are descendants of Austronesians who settled there after making their way from Taiwan about 3,500 years ago. The woman's genome shows no trace of Austronesian DNA because she lived long before that migration took place. But a key question for researchers is whether the Bugis and Makassar people have ties to ancient group to which she belonged. Indonesian scientists involved with the project have named the woman Bese, which is a Bugis word for young woman. Although physically different from the current population of Sulawesi, the Bese will still be considered part of human history on the island, says a study co-author Muhammad Noor, an archaeologist at the University of Hasanuddin in South Sulawesi, Indonesia. Bruman says that no trace of the woman's genetic lineage has so far been found in samples taken from modern-day inhabitants of Sulawesi. However, this could be because the diverse population has not been sampled thoroughly enough. It's possible that descendants of these Tholian people survived and lived on in some parts of South Sulawesi until recently, and their gens could still be surviving today, even though their culture disappeared thousands of years ago.
Around the World with Reporters.
In a first conference, Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip declared the return of nighttime protests, also known as night confusion operations along the buffer zone, to reject the Israeli blockade on the enclave.
It is time to end this crippling siege completely. We gave the mediators many chances to end this siege, and there are no more chances for any delay. Our people have got enough of the suffering. We will not leave our positions and won't stop the confrontation until Israel ends the blockade. Israeli settlers nearby won't witness peace as long as our people are not living in peace. We won't stay silent over the misery our people live in.
Palestinian protesters staged a demonstration near the buffer zone, burning tires and launching incendiary balloons at the Israeli army. The demonstrators were voicing their anger at the deteriorating quality of life in the Gaza Strip, caused by a crippling Israeli blockade since 2007. On Saturday, 13-year-old Omar Hassan Abu Nil died of injuries after being shot by the Israeli soldiers during an anti-Israeli protest held a week before.
If the Israeli regime keeps committing these crimes against our people, we will continue the fight and confront the regime here. Israel should know that we are only fighting for our right to live a decent life. This is our land, and we won't leave it, no matter the cost.
Palestinian Resistance Front says it will escalate clashes with Israel as long as the regime keeps its suffocating siege on Gaza, hampering life in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
State security forces on standby in Washington, D.C. were activated today as Palestinians marched toward the White House to condemn the first meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. That summit was ultimately postponed after a series of bombing attacks in Afghanistan, but protesters were quickly driven out of Lafayette Park regardless. They denounced not just the heavy-handed police tactics, but also President Biden's decision to host Bennett and his refusal to hold Israel accountable for its crimes against Palestinian people.
You're really violating our constitutional rights. To express ourselves in front of the administration, to the administration, and you're just using your power to ask us to.
Let us say that we're here to condemn this visit by this war criminal, the new Israeli Prime Minister, Bennett. He's calling for a war with Iran. He wants a new war against the Gaza Strip. He's not here with a proposal to give the Palestinians their rights.
In a symbolic move, the protesters made their way to the Willard Hotel, where the Israeli Prime Minister is staying, and read aloud the names and ages of Palestinians recently killed by the regime.
Mira Rami Abula, 12. Yadan Rami Abula, 13. Amir Rami Abula, 9.
With Israel stepping up its economic and military siege on the Gaza Strip once again, activists all over the world have renewed their efforts to mobilize for Palestinian liberation. But many say it's right here in D.C. that Israel's real base of power lies.
The police aren't letting demonstrators anywhere near the White House. They are keeping Palestinians and their supporters at least two blocks away, but that has not kept organizers from staying on the move. They say they won't stop until the Biden administration stops being complicit in Israeli war crimes. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
The holiday season has ended, but the protests against the mandatory health pass are continuing. Only in Paris, three different marches took place, dozens all over France. The health pass is an electronic document that people have to show before entering public places. Medical figures show that in areas with more than 70% of people vaccinated, the transmission of the virus and the death qualities are very low. But many people continue to protest because they do not trust the government discourse.
I absolutely don't believe in what they say. We are facing these honest people, liars. These people want to suppress our liberties and control us.
For me, there is something fishy going on here. I do not have any trust in this vaccine.
But medical figures seem to show the opposite. Today, end of August, 65% of the French population has received two jabs of the anti-COVID vaccine. The French health minister, Olivier Véran, himself a neurologist, administered an injection in front of the cameras. He said that people should fear the virus, not the vaccine. French officials say that the COVID crisis is getting under control thanks to the accelerated vaccination campaign and some mandatory measures. In French overseas territories, however, like Martinique, La Réunion or Guadeloupe, the situation is getting out of control because less than 30% of the people there are vaccinated. COVID infections and death casualties are high. Hospitals are full and the lockdown and curfew have been extended. Today, more than 90% of people who arrive in hospitals with severe symptoms of the COVID virus or who die from the virus are non-vaccinated persons. But the mistrust in the vaccine remains high.
Why do they force me to be injected with an unknown product, a pseudo-experimental vaccine? Normally, a vaccine is first tested on animals, then on volunteers. Today, the government threatens and blackmails an entire population. Restaurant workers and health personnel can be fired.
Hospital workers are now obliged to be vaccinated or have to show a negative PCR test. If not, they will be suspended without salary. Most of the protesters do not deny that the vaccination campaign in France seems to be successful, but they would like the French government to use the method of persuasion rather than a restriction. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
A scene of desperation transformed into one of horror in the waning days of the U.S.-led occupation. Two terrorist attacks on Kabul Airport. Claimed by Daesh. Dozens killed, among them children and U.S. troops. Hundreds more injured. British troops were spared this time. The U.K. Prime Minister says he's sticking to the evacuation plans.
The military, the Foreign Office teams, the Home Office, the Border Force teams are there getting people through as fast as they can still. And we're going to keep going up until the last moment.
That last moment comes on August 31st. Thousands, including British troops and eligible Afghans, are yet to be evacuated, and the threat of more attacks is looming. Pressure on the government over its handling of the crisis is mounting.
The Foreign Secretary shouts now, but he stayed on holiday while our mission in Afghanistan was disintegrating. You cannot coordinate an international response from the beach.
It's a shambolic end to a 20-year-long U.S.-led occupation, leaving ordinary Afghans to fend for themselves in a country torn by decades of war.
They invaded on a pretext which was a false pretext, and then for 20 years they've spent $2 to $3 trillion destroying that country. The future in that regard is tough for the Afghani people. They're starting from a very low base as one of the poorest countries on earth, but there are resourceful, ingenious people who are well capable of lifting themselves out of their current situation.
The UK followed the US and their NATO allies into Afghanistan in 2001, purportedly to topple the Taliban, only to hand the country back to the militant group two decades later.
Imperialism invades for reasons of extraction of material wealth, to dominate markets, to dominate labor, to dominate resources. They had a geostrategic policy to dominate the oil of that region. Forget their talk about green energy. They want to extract the maximum fossil fuels from the Middle East and dominate every government, any government which stands in their way and is non-compliant.
The Kabul airport attacks will probably not be the last ones. A taste of what to expect in post-occupation Afghanistan.
Experts say what's happening in Afghanistan right now is another crisis created by an illegal war waged by the U.S., the U.K., and other NATO countries. Another example that military invasion or intervention is not conducive to stability or lasting peace. Saeed Purizza, London.
strategy?
Turkey still seems to be undecided over the issue of the Kabul airport. The Turkish president said Ankara is still yet to decide on a request by the Taliban to run the airport. This came in a presser held in Atatürk Airport ahead of a trip the president is taking to Sarajevo. After Turkey's decision to withdraw troops located at the Kabul airport, the Taliban asked Turkey's assistance in operating the airport. Ankara says it isn't against the idea. However, there are certain things that the Taliban should provide first, such as securing the airport, especially after the latest bombing that took place on Thursday.
The Taliban have made a request regarding the operation of Kabul airport. They say we'll ensure security and you can operate it. But we have not made a decision yet because there's always the possibility of death and such things there.
Turkish president said the hesitation is due to several factors. The main one is the current power vacuum, assuring that a decision will be made once a new government is formed, and security is prevailed in Afghanistan. He added that commercial flights to Kabul will not be resumed now. Turkey urged the Taliban earlier to form an inclusive government, which includes former Afghan leaders. Ankara said those politicians have a certain credibility internationally and would help in ensuring political stability. Turkey is currently working to evacuate its citizens from Afghanistan. However, it seems that Ankara plans to accept Taliban's offer to run the airport, assuring that it is very important to keep the airport functioning to help receive aid supplies. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Italian government is considering further expanding its Green Pass scheme, which is part of a plan that aims to have 80% of its citizens vaccinated against the pandemic by the end of September. Despite a significant recent slowdown in the vaccination rate, about 60% of the population has received both doses of COVID-19 vaccine in Italy so far. The government is now considering making it a requirement for employees to show proof of vaccination, testing or recovery at workplaces, including public offices and supermarkets.
Mind you, the Sicily region, which has the lowest number of vaccinated people, could soon be classified as a high-risk red zone. The vast majority of those in intensive care units these days have not been vaccinated, and the Green Pass scheme serves the purpose of changing their mind.
Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has repeatedly said that the use of the Green Pass scheme is the only alternative to a new lockdown. However, a conspicuous number of Italians are opposing the government's anti-COVID rules that they say infringe on their civil liberties.
Many in Italy are not willing to get vaccinated and are against the mandatory anti-COVID Green Pass. Earlier this month, protests were held in several Italian cities against the introduction of new measures requiring proof of vaccination.
L'essere umano è così, non siamo mai tutti.
That's how people are made. We cannot agree on everything, but the vaccine and the Green Pass is the way to go.
Enough with excuses. We are not kids. Maybe our authorities should be more severe with those who refuse to get vaccinated.
Since August 6, the Green Pass has been required in order to enter cultural and leisure venues across Italy. From September the 1st, the pass will also be a requirement for all teachers and other school staff. However, the National Association of Head Teachers warned on Wednesday that schools are not equipped to check all the students' vaccine passports. Max Civili, Rome.
Representative of the World Health Organization to the Islamic Republic of Iran, Dr. Jafar Hussain, has visited one of the main vaccination centers in capital Tehran to closely monitor the process of vaccination. In a country where the Delta variant of the coronavirus is killing almost 700 people on a daily basis. During his visit, he learned about different phases of the process, both before and after the vaccination. The WHO representative said that despite sanctions and economic problems, Iran is among countries which has already paid for vaccines from COVAX, but the delivery of the vaccines has been delayed for different reasons.
Iran is a country which has paid already for 16.8 million doses from COVAX, already paid. with all the economic sanctions, everything it is facing. The problem is that because of the major outbreaks in other part of the world, like India, like Brazil and other, the vaccine availability globally reduced. What our Director General is recommending to every country head of the state, that it is a whole of society, whole of government approach to control COVID. Not only government can do it, not only WHO can do it, not only other UN, not only private, everybody has to join hand.
The number of outpatients with COVID-19 has decreased by almost 2% this week. We anticipate that the number of hospitalizations will even come down next week.
Iran's death toll from COVID-19 has exceeded 100,000. The rapid rise in COVID-19 cases and deaths in the past weeks has prompted Iranian officials to make utmost efforts to import more vaccines and accelerate the vaccination pace.
According to official reports, almost 10% of the Iranian population have already received two jabs of the COVID-19 vaccines. Experts say the pace is too slow. Accordingly, the new Iranian government has vowed to take all necessary measures to accelerate the vaccination pace and manage the pandemic as soon as possible. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
In its latest saber-rattling against Iran, Israel has said it may have to resort to military action against the Islamic Republic. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz made the threat, accusing Iran of seeking to build a nuclear weapon. He said military action must be considered as a plan B to prevent Iran from accessing the materials for a nuke. Meanwhile, the chief of the staff of the Israeli military made a similar threat, saying the regime is speeding up its, quote, operational plans against Iran. He also noted that Israel has recently approved a military budget to expand its capabilities against the Islamic Republic. Israel's blatant confessions of its warmongering policies come as it points to recent increases in uranium enrichment as evidence that Iran is racing toward producing a bomb. Israel has been alleging that Iran is trying to build nuclear weapons since the 1980s, but it has failed to produce any evidence to support its claims.
Israeli aggression and attack against the Islamic Republic of Iran will be a matter of the existence of the Zionist entity. They are trying to bother from one time to time by cyber, digital, electronic warfare, but Iran is proven its capability of equality and competition among superpowers in this field.
Iran, on the other hand, has pledged that any aggression against it will be met with a decisive response regardless of where it comes from.
No one in Iran takes this seriously. The Israeli regime has just ended a major catastrophic loss in its conflict with the Palestinian people. So when the Israelis cannot defeat a Palestinian people who are surrounded in a concentration camp called Gaza, then the Israeli regime is in no position to talk about military confrontation with Iran.
Moreover, Iranian officials have on many occasions stressed that Tehran does not want a war, but that Iran will give a crushing response to aggressors. Israel says it wants to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear arms, while Tel Aviv remains the only possessor of nuclear weapons in the region. In 2008, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter said Israel holds at least 150 nuclear weapons. It was the first time a U.S. president publicly acknowledged Israel's atomic arsenal.
Suicide bombers set off two blasts in Afghanistan's capital Kabul on Thursday. The bombings took place outside Hamid Karzai International Airport as thousands were awaiting evacuations following a Taliban takeover of Kabul. Casualties included Afghan civilians and American forces. The U.S. troops suffered their heaviest casualty toll in a single incident in Afghanistan since 2011. In response, President Joe Biden promised punishment for the perpetrators. Biden, under enormous pressure over his administration's handling of the Afghan crisis, said the airlift would continue.
We will not forgive. We will not forget. we will hunt you down and make you pay. We will not be deterred by terrorists. We will not let them stop our mission. We will continue the evacuation.
More than 100,000 people have been flown out of Afghanistan since the Taliban swept into power on August 15. The Taliban had allowed the U.S.-led forces to conduct the airlift while planning to finalize their own government as soon as the American troops left. U.S. forces are racing to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by an August 31 deadline set by President Biden. His administration is facing growing criticism over the situation in Afghanistan and what is seen as a hasty withdrawal after two decades of military presence. Biden, however, says the U.S. has long ago achieved its original rationale for invading Afghanistan in 2001, to root out al-Qaeda militants and prevent a repeat of the September 11 attacks on the United States. Analysts believe the U.S. has failed to achieve any of its objectives.
Despite spending $200 million per day over the past 20 years, accumulating well in excess of some $2-3 trillion of U.S. taxpayer money, despite sending hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops, our youth, our sisters and brothers who are now traumatized, some lost life and limb, U.S. imperialism has very clearly lost. They've been kicked out by an indigenous resistance.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan with the stated goal of toppling the Taliban and improving security there. 20 years on, nothing has changed on the ground except the death of tens of thousands of innocent civilians. That, along with the current chaotic pullout, has more than ever raised questions on Washington's real intention about its Afghanistan operation.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the VIRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
Today I have come to my grandma's home. I have come here in order to help my grandma in organizing her books and dusting her little bookshelf. This shelf has the collections of poems of great Iranian poets. This is the Divan of Hafez. Oh, how beautiful the miniature is. And it's the Golestan of Saadi. And, this is the collection of Khayyam's quatrains. Oh, it's so dusty. while I dust and sort out the books, get yourself ready for a new tour. Today we are going to visit a big library in Tehran, to the National Library of Iran. The first building of the National Library of Iran was built next to the building of National Museum of Iran. This building was designed by French architect and archaeologist André Godard. The National Library of Iran was officially opened in 1937. Years later, in 1961, a new building was attached to the library. In 2005, the new building of the National Library of Iran was established. The new 8-story building has been constructed in an area of 97,000 square meters. The new building of the National Library of Iran is seismic resistant and is so strong that can even withstand earthquakes measuring 9 on the Richter scale. The National Library of Iran has the capacity to house 4 to 7 million books. I am now in the area of the National Library of Iran. Here is a very green, beautiful environment, and just across from me, there is a big building. It's a brick-made building. This building gives me the kind of sense which buildings with Iranian architecture radiate, a sense of peace and calm. Let's go inside. The National Library of Iran has 9 study halls, each named after an Iranian renowned person. I am now in Khwarazmi Hall, which is very big. This hall has rare and manuscript books. In Khwarazmi Hall, a rich collection of manuscripts and lithographs are kept. I am now in Rudaki Study Hall. This hall is dedicated to people with low vision or blindness. Several people are studying in this hall, and I better not to disturb them. Oh my God, this library is so huge. I don't think I could visit all the study halls. It takes much time. Well, the structure of the National Library of Iran has stair-like and pyramid-like architecture. This architectural characteristic has made it appropriate for the main spaces and study halls to enjoy the natural light. I should bring my grandma to this library. Sure, she will like it. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Did women also play a role in the event of Ashura? February 8, 2010. Asiya, the wife of Pharaoh, did not have to endure the psychological pains that Zainab al-Kubra went through. On the day of Ashura, Zainab al-Kubra watched many of her dear ones go to the battlefield to get martyred. She watched Hussein ibn Ali, Abbas, Ali Akbar, Qasim, her children, and other dear ones go to the battlefield. After they were martyred, she went through all those pains, the invasion of the enemy, disrespect, and the responsibility to take care of the surviving children and women. Is it possible to compare the enormity of this tragedy with physical pain? But when she was faced with these difficulties, Zainab al-Kubra did not tell God to save her. She did not say, Oh my Lord, save me. On the day of Ashura, she said, Oh God, accept this from us. While the shredded body of her brother lay in front of her eyes, tells God, Oh God, accept this sacrifice from us. When she was asked to describe what she had seen, she replied, I did not see anything but beauty.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latsham.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Ana latsham, ana
latsham. All those tragedies were beautiful to Zainab al-Kubra because they were from and for God, because they were supposed to promote the word of God. See how different this position, this patience, and this love of justice and truth are compared to Asiya's position described in the Holy Quran. This shows the greatness of Zainab's position. This is the nature of actions that are carried out for the sake of God. Therefore, Zainab's actions are currently a model, and her name and achievement